Hey listeners, just want to preface this episode with a content warning because we discuss sexual assault. Hello, and welcome to JK It's Magic, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties read YA fantasy through a critical lens. Why? Because critique is our fangirl love language, and because talking about books is pretty magical.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Jessie.
And today we're discussing Siege and Storm by Leigh Bardugo, the second book in the Grisha trilogy. Plot summary? Alina and Mal have escaped the Darkling, for now. Then they get captured. Then they escape again. And then everything goes to shit.
I really like this book a lot better than the first one. It was a lot more fast-paced, and there was a lot of action in this story, and I think I liked it better in part because there was less of Mal and Alina walking and traveling around, and less of Mal in general.
Seconded. I love this book because it's where we get introduced to my favorite character, Nikolai.
Yes, he's pretty awesome, with a little caveat.
Yeah, oh. I have thoughts. We'll get to them. Yeah, I like this book. I think the pacing is definitely better in this book.
I don't really like travel stories that much. So I think the first book, because I read it and then reread it so soon afterwards, I was like, oh my gosh, that was not as fun as I thought it was the first time. I think I could reread this book and be like really happy.
Right. And I think part of it is because we see Alina in community with more interesting characters. We get more interesting interactions, I would say.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm excited for you to read the third one.
I'm excited to read it too. I thought about reading it right away afterwards, but I was like, oh, I gotta read all these other books. And now I'm off of the podcast books right now.
Let's talk about all things world building in Through the Wardrobe.
So there was a lot more in this book talking about religion with Alina in her sainthood and the apparat and Tolia. So on page 98, they say that religion, so serious, faith-abiding, service-attending religion is for the peasants, which I found really interesting. And I think maybe it's something we do see in, you know, in our world, people who actually attend masses and services and actually do like the work of being religious are not people who we would consider like upper class people.
I think there is a parallel or a connection that tends to be made between devout religiosity, if that's a word, and class.
Mm-hmm.
I think because sometimes religion gets bunched in with like ignorance sometimes,
right?
With like lack of education. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that really holds water necessarily, but I agree with you that the book certainly is saying that. But what's interesting is that the apparat was this spiritual council to the monarchy. Right. So clearly religion does have a place.
Yeah.
Somehow. And the apparat's shown, at least in the first book, as being a really powerful figure, as having the ear of the king.
Right. Which I guess we do see, like, there are those, like, big name religious people who, like, advise presidents and politicians and, like, monarchs. And I don't know. I wonder if they're actually religious, like, they really believe what they're saying, or if they kind of do it as a way to have power.
I don't know if you can separate the power out from the equation because, I mean, I think it's like calls to like. Grisha magic, power, yeah. You know, calls to other power.
Right.
So people in powerful political institutions often align themselves with people in powerful religious institutions.
That's true. Yeah, because when I think of like politicians and their like religiosity always seems like a little fake in that they believe a lot of things, but like what they do, like their actions don't confirm those beliefs. They right. actually do the opposite.
And that's certainly the case for what we see with Ravka.
Right.
Because we don't really see devotion on the part of the nobles or the monarchy. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are religious buildings, like we see the chapel.
Right.
And the apparat, but we don't really see them attending services or anything like that.
And even the chapel's kind of like run down a little bit. Like she talks about the painting, the mural of the saint being like water damaged. And obviously they didn't fix it. And they're not putting their resources towards those kind of things.
No, they care more about the parties and the glitz and glamour.
So on page 168, it talks about how both faith slash religion and superstition are powerful things, but I think they both require belief in a higher power who cares about you and what you do. And I thought that was really interesting. Olya tries to put those two things together as if they're similar, but it's interesting to me how Alina separates superstition from religion so much.
Yeah, I don't see why they can't be connected.
I don't see how they're not. If you're superstitious that, like, walking under a ladder will cause you problems, like, who causes those problems?
Right. I guess it just depends if you're going to make that connection or not. I think that's more right. Happens on an individual level.
Yeah. But I just thought it was really interesting, the connection they made between the two. I don't remember who said this, something about religion breeds fanaticism in the book. And it was interesting when Alina leaves the palace and everyone's like wants to touch her and like have a part of her, and so they're literally like pulling her hair out to have a piece of her. And that to me was really surprising, to think about the way people treat the people they see as saints or like religious figures.
Yeah, I think this connects actually to what we were talking about in the Ship It episode about how fandom can mm-hmm. like love can take a dark turn,
right,
and breed fanaticism essentially,
right?
And I think it just speaks to the power of affects, really, and yeah. especially ones that are considered positive ones, like love or right. adoration, and how if you take them too far, I guess it's just this fear of extreme emotion is what I'm saying. Like it's mm-hmm. it's very much holding up logic and rationality as something to strive for, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily the way to go. 100%.
And it's also interesting too, because I wonder if the people who are the people who are the fanatics, like, do they realize that they're hurting the person that they're ascribing to this higher place?
Maybe they don't think that that person can be hurt because they are a saint.
Oh, because they do think she died and came back to life. She's like, she's a Jesus figure to them.
Yes. She's this sort of promised messianic figure. I'm curious how much the apparat had to deal with that. How much of this is like a really grassroots cult rather than one that's getting preached top down?
I think I assume that it was top down, like the apparat. Well, I don't know what his role is outside the palace before he left. Was he like a priest?
Yeah, he's a priest of the religion, whatever it is.
But like, is he like similar to like the Pope? Is he like the top priest?
I got the impression that he was high up in whatever religious institution they have, because mm-hmm. it wasn't clear. But yeah, he's like a figurehead.
I took it as everything coming down from him, because he like says she died and came back to life, and he is like making her into a saint. And I think it's something maybe he always wanted to do, because he gave her the Book of Saints.
I don't know. I'm conflicted about it. I don't know how much power the apparat has over this, or how much this is the people wanting something to believe in, and so then they graft onto her. Can we talk about Alina's relationship to her sainthood?
Yes. I guess this is the time.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
I think it's a weird situation, because obviously I don't think she wants to be seen as a saint, but she seems to be taking advantage of the fact that she is seen as one.
She seems very bristly. She bristles right. against this idea of her as a saint. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's because part of the story is based on a lie.
You don't think it's because of that?
No, I think it's because of her like relationship to herself and her own self-worth. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she believes in it that much. And so seeing other people ascribe her so much power and importance, I don't know, I feel like it brings up this like wound, this inner
right.
trauma going on.
Yeah, because she doesn't have like the highest opinion of herself. That's very obvious. And in a lot of ways, she doesn't think she's worthy. Like, she continues to call the Darkling's bedroom the Darkling's bedroom, even though he's not there. Like, even though she's taken his place and realizes like she's the responsible one for all the Grisha now, she still sees herself as second best. And maybe that's why she doesn't think she has the right to this, even though it's kind of false sainthood.
Right. I think what part of it is she can't accept her own power or can't right. see it. Mm-hmm. She does in certain areas. Like, she knows that because she has the two amplifiers, she's super powerful. But I think she's still conflicted, knowing that the Darkling was the one who killed Mortsova's stag. So how much of that power is hers? But then again, she did fight him off on the fold and seemed to get that power back for herself. The fetter is something that she and Mal killed the Sea Whip together. So that's her power alone, supposedly.
I'm not sure I believe that.
We'll see.
You can't tell me, but I'm worried. I think that Mal is going to have more power in the next book. That's my guess.
No comment. I don't know. I think it's just like Alina's relationship to her fictional sainthood is really interesting to me.
Maybe part of it is that she feels like she didn't do any of it on her own. Like you were saying, because she didn't kill the stag by herself or the sea whip, she feels like she owes something to other people.
Yeah, I think she still feels super ordinary and not special, which I guess is good, right? Because if she fully embraced this power,
yeah,
I think that's how you turn it into the Darkling.
Which we see her struggle with a bit. Like, she's worried that she wants the Firebird so badly, and she sees herself, like, lashing out at people in violent ways, and she worries about becoming him.
So I think that it's good that she has this conflicted relationship to the religious devotion mm-hmm. that people are giving her, but it's also kind of shows maybe a window into the things she's working with on an individual level.
Yeah. I think even when people are in places of power, sometimes they still feel like worthless. And that's really difficult to deal with. And I don't think even if you felt worthless before, adding power to the equation doesn't make you feel better about yourself.
No, you know? It can turn you down a really dark path, I think.
Right. Because now the expectations for her are so high.
Right. And the stakes are so much higher.
Yeah, exactly.
Wands out. This is the segment when we discuss all things magic.
Sea dragons exist now. So now there's no reason to not believe in anything anymore.
So we can believe in everything now.
Unicorns probably exist. Firebird, I'm guessing, is like a phoenix.
Oh, yeah, that's a good connection.
That was a depiction I got of it.
Hadn't put that together, yeah.
But it might be because I just was reading Harry Potter.
I guess in this book, we see that the various understandings of magic differ between countries and cultures. Even though we don't spend too much time in those other places in Siege and Storm, we do hear kind of reiterated that Fjordans burn Grisha as witches. So this to me, that this implies that Fjordans connect magic to religion, to whatever the Grisha magic would be like, connected to whatever the opposite of their god is.
Right.
Which is in the Christian tradition, that would be like connected to Lucifer.
Yeah.
Or hell or demons.
Right. Something evil.
Exactly. And then there's this like necessity to purify the evil that manifests through magical people.
Yeah. And it's really like reminiscent of like witch burnings.
And a different country and culture that has a relationship with magic is the Shu. They believe that magical power derives from some physical organ or physical substance in the body that you can actually locate and then extract, which is why they run experiments on Grisha, versus in Ravka, where they're still used, but yes, not dissected or burned.
I guess we see this in things like X-Men, where they're like, I mean, they're not forced to become X-Men because they have these powers, but we see that kind of in that Marvel universe, where some of them are experimented on, like Wolverine, and then some of them become X-Men, but they all can like go to this school, kind of like the palace.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of like X-Men. The Grisha are X-Men.
They totally are.
I just thought of that, and now they're X-Men to me. With very, very specific powers.
Tolia makes this comment that says Grisha are born, not made. And I'm not sure why it struck out to me, but I wanted to hear your thoughts.
I know. I thought this was an interesting comment because it insinuates that you can't become a Grisha. Even if you're born in one of these faraway places, or like Alina, you try and like tamper down your powers, like you're still a Grisha no matter what.
I would argue that Alina was made. Had she not had that incident on the fold where Mal got injured not happened, then she probably would have never discovered her power, ever.
I don't know, because I wonder if like there would come a point where she wouldn't be able to like hold it in anymore. But I guess that's kind of what we see on the fold. But I wonder if it would like manifest in a different way. Like, of course, she's always feeling sick and tired and like blah, blah, blah. But I wonder if eventually like the power builds up so much she wouldn't be able to hold it in.
I wonder if like we can make a parallel to a race here, because I'm born white, but that like all layers of meaning and associations are grafted onto me based on the like my skin color.
Right.
So the same thing happens for Grisha, I think. Like, you have this innate phenotype or right. something, but then that accrues social and cultural meaning based on like years of construction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, because Grisha seemed to Grisha magic and being Grisha don't necessarily seem like the same thing to me.
Right.
Like, there are people who have powers like Tolya and Tamar, but don't ascribe to the same hierarchies or ideologies
right.
that, like, what's that dude's name? The annoying one.
Ivan?
No, the other one.
Sergey?
Sergey.
There's a lot of annoying dudes in this
book. That, like, Sergey, Marie, etc., Grisha, Hogwarts crew, they just seem like two totally different types of people to me.
I guess it's kind of like capital G Grisha, like lowercase g Grisha. In the deaf community, it's capital D deaf, which means you're, like, part of the community of deaf people, and you, like, it includes people who are hard of hearing, but who, like, sign, that sort of thing, and take part in, like, community activities. So I wonder if we kind of get something similar to that with the Grisha. So, like, Tolya and Tamar would be, like, lowercase g Grisha, and the Grisha who are part of, like, the Second Army and who surround themselves with other Grisha and take part in, like, the activities would be, like, capital G Grisha.
Yeah, I guess the hearing you say that makes me think that there's a difference between having Grisha power and technically being Grisha and mm-hmm. then being a Grisha who grew up in the institution
right.
that is the Little Palace and the right. Second Army and the Darkling and the connection to the Ravkin monarchy.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of makes sense, too, because, like, the other Grisha at, like, Grisha Hogwarts don't really want Alina to be in charge, and maybe it's because she's, like, lowercase g Grisha. Like, she didn't grow up there. She didn't, like, conform to the social norms when she started there. She didn't, like, want to take part in a lot of things. So they're like, we don't want you to be in charge.
I think that's exactly when Tolya says Grisha are born, not made. Right. So it doesn't matter if Alina mm-hmm. is
like
a peasant.
He's saying, like, you get to be part of this community whether you grew up in it or not.
Yeah, it's upending that the class hierarchy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Wands away.
Now we're going to talk about conflict, villains, and good versus evil in a segment we're calling Get Me Kylo Ren. So there's a lot of bad shit going on. Just like all the bad things happen in this book. When they're on the fold and there was Sturmhund, who we later find out is Nikolai, but they don't know it yet. The people on the ship, the hummingbird, they kill a nest of Volcra. So that's like Volcra and like their children, I guess, the Volcra like babies. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of trophy hunting. And I was wondering what you thought about, like, does killing something that is considered a monster make you bad? Like, is it the wrong thing to do? Or is it wrong because they used to be humans?
I think you could consider it wrong in this case, or at least significantly more problematic, because it was an offensive, unprovoked attack going after the nest versus a defensive attack, which is all of the other interactions we've seen with humans and the Volcra. I think the fact that we see it through Alina's perspective and she has this connection to the Volcra now
right.
through her Nichivoya wound, I think then that is prompting the readers to see it as an issue. But I thought that this was inappropriate.
I agree. I could see why Alina felt like disturbed by it, because it felt so wrong. And maybe it is because we're getting it from Alina's perspective, but I don't see the point of killing something that is like doing you no harm for absolutely no reason.
Yeah, and it's also not those beings' fault that they are the way they are.
No. Maybe she feels she feels worse about it because they are a product of, like, a Darkling. He created the Fold and he created them, but she also feels, like, a little bit created by the Darkling.
And I guess she is one of the only people who knows that the Darkling is the one who created the Volcra, because everyone else thinks that it's the Black Heretic.
And they don't believe her when she tells them it was a Darkling anyways.
No one else believes her. She's the only one who knows that the Darkling is a continuous thread, that he's 500 plus years old or whatever.
Right, right.
So I guess everyone else isn't making that connection, isn't seeing them as a product of a human's mistakes.
I'm not sure I think it was okay anyways.
It's not.
I was really surprised about the Darkling making himself weak to get to Alina. So when he creates the, what are they called?
Nichivoya?
Yep. When he creates them, it makes him weaker. And I thought she would take more advantage of that. And I kind of wish she did.
She kind of does at the end, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't really work out.
So. Not really.
I mean, I guess that's kind of because, like, Mal saves her again.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Eye roll.
Yeah. Huge eye roll. Like, my eyes hurt from rolling them so hard.
So the Darkling is weakening himself to create the Nichi Voya, but the Nichi Voya themselves are very powerful.
But I was just surprised that he would make himself vulnerable at all.
He's also making himself vulnerable in those moments when he comes and visits Alina.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, I think I like the I like how the book dramatizes and narrates the connection between the two of them.
Right.
Through this otherworldly, it's almost like Anand's dreamscape from Children of Blood and Bone.
Yeah.
They're together, but they're not, but they are.
Well, yeah, like Anand's dreamscape, like he can physically touch her, or she could touch him if she wanted to. But I just thought that was strange. It's like a projection of himself, like a fully formed projection of himself that's coming to her in real life. And that was really strange. But no one else can see him.
I think it's almost metaphorical for the Darkling's influence on Alina and how he's been such an important figure in her development as a character. Like, he basically made her who she is because he's the one who first called her power. He's the one who set her down this path of getting all sorts of different amplifiers, who saw her as special and as his opposite, but also his complement.
Right.
And I think it's important that the novel shows the readers the very intimate, fraught, complicated connection that's between the two, because I think she also has an influence on him.
That's true. That makes sense. Like, one, he's like has these projections coming to her, and that's like his way of like lording something over her. But then he uses the shadow creatures and doing that makes him vulnerable, and he also does that to get to her. So it's like this weird kind of power dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah, and the fact that they're in this like dreamscape together, I think, shows very effectively that they have a connection that no one else can possibly understand. We see Alina getting darker in this book.
A lot darker.
She almost kills Sergei.
We see him coming to her, like, the darker she gets. So there's something there, I think, as well.
Yeah, I think it's book 2 of 3. So we're in the middle of her seeing who she wants to be.
Yeah, I wonder what she's going to decide to do. Because the book ends with her being like, I can't summon my powers anymore. And, like, her hair turned white. And I was like, okay, like, but what does this mean? You know?
Yeah, you'll have to wait till book 3.
I know. I'm just like trying to make all my predictions now so that later I can be like, oh yeah, I was right or I was wrong.
Vasily, you have feelings.
He's just the worst, the absolute worst, and I was glad when he died.
Vasily is the worst, and I think he's set up to be bad.
People for some reason don't like a prince who is like pampered, and he like spends his days like at the races and spending money on things that are unreasonable expenses, especially when their country is going through a really difficult time money-wise. Like, the people are not doing well, so Vasily is like definitely set up to be the bad guy.
Yeah, he's set to take monarchy to the extreme, essentially. I think he's the epitome of what Tolya and Tamar say when they come to the little palace, and they say this is a place where people go to get soft. And that's what we see. And then Nikolai is not that way, because he's spent the majority of his life either in anonymity or working his way up through the ranks, because he joined the infantry first. He doesn't have just like an honorary title. He actually did it, y'all.
Yeah.
But he was a monarch. So like how many props do you want? Vasily's awfulness reinforces the fact that the novel wants us to side with Nikolai. And I do. I fall into it.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't? Like, given those two choices.
Well, and he's a monarchist who cares for his people and who wants to do the right thing.
Right.
I think he wants to do the right thing.
But in the end, it's a false choice, because monarchy is not the only option.
Yeah, exactly. Like, even Nikolai is like really wants to hold on to the power that his family has.
Yes.
I wonder what Fyrda and like the Shuhan have as like their forms of government. Because I wonder if they've ever even seen anything different.
Fyrda is also monarchy. Shuhan, I don't know. In Six of Crows, we see Kedderdam. The Kirch are merchants. So it's like a council of wealthy merchants.
Oh, okay. Which is, I guess, not really a democracy. I don't know what that is.
Oligarchy? Kleptocracy?
Yeah. So I wonder what their like other options are. Yeah.
But Nikolai definitely wants to hold on to that power. And in that way, I think we can definitely talk about him and Get Me Kylo Ren. Because holding on to your power as a monarch isn't, it's for you, it's not for your people.
That's the problem with a monarchy, I think, is that part of being part of a monarchy is that you have to want to maintain that power, even if it's not always what's best for your people. But I guess we see that in democracy as well.
Listeners, you wouldn't simply walk into Mordor, and so we're not simply going to read fantasy without talking about representations of race, class, and gender. This is our segment about power and bodies and how they relate.
All right, let's start with talking about gender. Sturmhund says his client who wants Lena could be a woman. And at that point, I didn't know he was Nikolai and that he's the one who wanted Lena. But I was like, good for you, you know? Even though he maybe isn't the most feminist of people. I really liked that. Tamar is a super badass and I love it. Her with her axes.
Tamar's depicted as like the best fighter.
Tolia is the one, he's like the big hulking guy who like gets them out of the crowd. But I don't think it could have happened without Tamar.
Yeah, she reminds me of Brienne of Tarth, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, I love Brienne of
Tarth. Just like so steadfast, so loyal.
Yeah. Yeah, because Brienne of Tarth is like that where she's like, I made this promise, I'm going to keep it no matter what.
Yeah, Oathkeeper is her sword.
Yeah. She's the best.
We also see a little bit more of Zoya being powerful. Not too much.
No, but it's good. I think the book does, and Leigh Bardugo does a really good job of having women with like a power that is equal and amounts to what the men have.
But there's still men in charge everywhere, which I'm confused about. The king, yeah. Nikolai, yeah. Vasily, the Darkling.
The apparat.
The apparat.
Like, yeah. And so maybe that's kind of part of the problem that Sergei and some of the other Grisha have with Alina being in charge is that she's a woman. And obviously the Darkling's been in charge for 500 years, so they've never had anything but a man in charge of them.
It's true. And she doesn't, huge scare quotes, look mm-hmm. like someone who holds power. She's small. She's a peasant.
Yeah.
She's an orphan.
Often sickly.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That's probably some of the reticence that they have is that she doesn't come off as someone who's entitled to power.
I also like that we see Alina like come into her own as someone who's really powerful, but also maybe a little bit bad. I don't know what she'll become in the next book, but I love a book that gives us like a complicated, maybe kind of bad female character. I know you haven't watched Sharp Objects yet, but all the women in that movie slash book, which I did not read, are really, really bad. And I really like when a story can like take a female and put her into something we see as like quote unquote like a male dominated field.
Right, because male characters, like men in general, are allowed to have more nuance. The men we have in our narratives, mm-hmm. just socially, white men, I should say, are allowed to have more nuance.
Yeah.
And to be good and bad.
Yeah, because even when you think of like fantasy sci-fi movies, like they always make the man the bad guy. And we even say bad guy.
Oh, you know? There you go.
And like, why can't a woman be the villain without it being like this doing it for a man or like this sexualized thing, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I like that your comment about Alina being a little bit bad because that makes her way more interesting as a character.
Yeah.
I like it a lot more. Let's move on to Mal.
I like don't really like Mal very much. And by that, I mean, I kind of hate him. And like, I thought he might die in this book and I was kind of happy about it.
He's pretty insufferable.
Yeah. And for some reason, he thinks he has an inherent right to Alina's body. And I really, really, really hate that.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. Like he doesn't want her to like someone else. She's not allowed. When Nikolai proposes to her, it was a trash proposal. One. But like, it wasn't very nice.
Mal's super threatened by other men.
Yeah, but in a way that he doesn't want to let Alina make that decision for herself. He's just like, she can't do that. And when Nikolai talks about the possibility of them having children before she even decides what she wants to do, Mal is so pissy about it.
He's a quintessential individualist.
Yeah.
He's only thinking about himself. He thinks he has also a right to Alina's attention and all of her effort. This attitude really comes out when they're discussing whether or not Mal will come back to Os Alta as well, because Alina makes a decision. She wants the Second Army. She wants to fight the Darkling in a more institutionally recognized role. And Mal is like, yeah, begrudgingly is like, fine, I'll come with you. And I just wonder if you'll want me at the end. I'll do all this stuff for you. I'm so self-sacrificing. It's like, you were barely paying attention. Yeah. You've been paying attention to her for like 3 minutes. And now all of a sudden she's just supposed to do everything for you.
Not only that, Alina and Mal have been spending like a lot of time apart because she's been really busy working with the Second Army and the Grisha and like trying to like create a better community for all of them. And then Mal's like, you're not spending enough time with me. I'm like, dude, she's really busy. Like, maybe let her have her time to do what she needs to do. If you love her, then you know that her time might need to be spent with people other than you sometimes.
Also, then you can recognize that she has a more important role than you.
Yeah, but deal with it. He does not like that. It's like the first time ever she's been more important than him.
And
like,
she's been in the spotlight.
Right, and he hates that. And I hate him for hating that.
He covets her attention and her love and her, yeah, it's very strange.
But like he doesn't want anyone else to be part of her life.
And then she thinks things are her fault. That like, oh, I should be paying more attention to him. Like, oh, I've made him feel so bad and so alone. And so, I don't know. I'm on Alina's side on this one. I'm just kind of like, he's not a good ally.
Right. And I mean, like, people are allowed to their feelings, but you're not responsible for their feelings. You can't tiptoe around people in order to make them feel better just because like they're being shitty to you.
And also because he just closes off. Yeah. He doesn't communicate to her.
Yeah, what like his tell issues her what are. You need.
He's never vulnerable to her. He's never owns up like, this is my thing, but this is how you're affecting me.
Right.
There's no communication. She is the one who's left to do all the emotional work for both of mm-hmm. them. No.
Not okay. And I hate Mal and I hope he dies in the next book. That is my hope. And Alina ends up with someone else altogether. Not Nikolai, but someone else.
This is the content warning part. I have very strong feelings about the sexual fucking assault that Alina suffers and endures when Nikolai kisses her without her consent in front of an enormous crowd when they are heading back to Os Alta on the Vi. They're like large processional. It's Nikolai's coming out, essentially. Hello, I'm back.
Yeah.
I love Nikolai so much as a character, but I had forgotten about this scene until I reread Siege and Storm for this episode. And I'm incredibly disappointed in his behavior in my own, like, myopia, like, not remembering and not seeing this. And also, his reasons about putting on a show and the crowd loved it are bullshit. And then Alina afterwards is the most upset about what Mal will think, that she's alone in the carriage with Nikolai. So she doesn't even have room to process her own feelings, and she goes straight to worrying about and tending to the emotions of the other dude in her life. And then she also, in like Nikolai also opens up in that moment when they're in the carriage together. So she's doing emotional work for Mal and for the dude who just assaulted her.
For everyone but herself.
Mm-hmm. This scene really got to me because A, the behavior is disgusting, and B, because when we're recording this and when I was rereading this book, we're in the middle of the Brett Kavanaugh's nomination hearings in the Senate, and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's like towering heroic testimony, and she's just like a fucking hero. And so I have zero tolerance for rape culture bullshit right now, and in particular zero tolerance ever,
right?
But right now in particular. But I think the scene with Nikolai shows that even people we love fuck up. So, I mean, if most of us women and feminine of center people know multiple individuals who've been assaulted, it stands to reason that we probably know people who have committed assault.
Right.
And I don't know what to do with it. I just was having these feelings when I read the scene and was processing after reading it and was really upset by it and just realizing that there's so much healing that's necessary and it's just overwhelming.
Yeah, it was a lot, and I didn't write it down when we were when I was reading this book, but we talked about it a little bit. Kelly and I talked about it as she was reading through it, and about how this is like something that we're supposed to see as like sexually okay for a guy to like kiss us when we don't want it or haven't asked, or they haven't asked, and that's something that we're seeing, like, women are seen as supposed to want
the man to take the lead.
Yeah. But to take the lead without asking permission.
Exactly.
Like, permission of our bodies.
I think both sides, and this is obviously in heterosexual relationships, yeah, or interactions.
Right.
That both sides are, what's the word I'm looking for? Both sides are programmed to think that asking for consent or giving consent is not sexy. It's not part of this, like, romantic interaction.
Or even, like, if you, you don't ask and they don't say no, then it's fine. And that's not okay. I mean, that's what he does. She gets mad afterwards and he like half-ass apologizes. But you should have just asked in the first place. Like, you don't have a right to touch another person.
Well, she already denied him.
Yeah, she already said no.
Exactly.
And he doesn't care because he's like, the people need to see this. And that's real shitty.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
He's using her and it's frustrating.
It's hard because I'm like, I don't know if he eventually starts to like her, like fall for her, or if it's all a ruse because he wants something for his country. Yeah, I don't know.
And I think it gets to the fact that Nikolai hasn't really interrogated what he wants. I don't think that he's been allowed to have wants, really.
Right.
I don't know. I think that the scene just really gets to the pervasiveness of rape culture, how it's in our books, how it's in our interactions. It's how it sometimes means that we're not holding the characters we love to a high enough standard.
I was thinking about this. As everyone knows, To All the Boys I Loved Before is like super popular right now, and I love it. But I thought about the part where Laura Jean like kisses Peter, even after he's like saying, hey, like, this was real nice of you to write me this letter, but I don't want that. Like, I don't want like a relationship with you. And he's like trying to let her down easy. And then she sees Josh and she like just kisses him. And I'm like, oh, that's also not okay.
That's also not consenting.
And we always like put the, like, I think because most sexual assault occurs with men being the perpetrators of the sexual assault, that we forget that sometimes also women should not, they should be asking for consent as well, you know?
Consent is something that's constantly negotiated, and everyone, regardless of your gender or your sexuality, needs to be asking for it and giving it.
Yeah, like in every moment. And I understand that that's hard and it seems like a lot of work, but that's the only way to like dismantle the rape culture.
Alina has her personal space violated over and over and over again. She's a prisoner a few times. At the very beginning of the book, she and Mal are in this boarding house that they have to share with everyone, so they get no time alone. Then she's a prisoner. Then she's with Sturmhaunt. Then she's with Nikolai, and then he sexually assaults her. And she has to, like, be this saint. Then she goes to the little palace and has to be everything for everyone. And her bedroom and her dreams aren't even safe because the Darkling can just violate her personal space anytime he wants. That's super scary.
Yeah.
And I think she's just in a very precarious position.
Yeah. And I think that maybe contributes to her PTSD a little bit.
Yeah, never feeling like you have a place where you can be safe.
Yeah, like she never feels safe. And I understand why. But even when she tries to leave the palace, you know, the people are like touching her without her permission and trying to literally take pieces of, like literally take pieces of her body. And it's like kind of, it's disgusting.
And yeah, she's not safe in her own head because of all the things that she's been through.
And she doesn't know like what influence the amplifiers are having on her mind. And that's making it difficult for her as well. Yeah, like, so her, like, even her mind is not a safe space.
Let's talk a little bit about race. We don't learn too much more about race relations or racial hierarchies in this book. And it just came back to me that we assume whiteness for Ravkins. Is that correct?
Yeah, I never assumed anything else. I think because we know Alina gets pale and maybe Mal has blue eyes.
It's so interesting, though, that, like, with zero prompting.
Yeah.
I just assumed everyone in this book was white.
I did, too. I think we talked about it in the first book that I thought maybe Zoya could have been a person of color because she had black hair. But then she also has blue eyes, and I think they talked about her being pale. We do get Tamar and Tolia. They're described as having bronze skin.
Which, again.
Yeah. Please tiptoe around people's skin color forever, white authors. Let's fix that. Which means they're brown-ish, maybe.
Tamar and Tolia are also from Shuhan, so we get, again, this connection between racial difference and, like, a different nationality.
Which is funny because of some of the things that they described for the Shuhan in the first book, in my head, they were more Asian. So then I saw bronze, and I was like, maybe they're a different kind of Asian than I was thinking. But then I don't know why I ascribed Asianness to them in general.
Well, because they talk about dragons and Shuhan rings.
I don't know.
Orientalized.
Yeah. So I think I pictured them that way. But then I think that also they're bronze skin. So I don't want to ignore like the diaspora and the option. Like there's a huge amount of colors that Asian people can be as well.
And I'm kind of curious as to why we don't have more different races or like people of different nationalities in the book, especially in the Second Army, because we get this narrative, especially in book one, that the Grisha flee the other places
right.
because they're persecuted. So it would make sense that they would come to Ravka because Grisha are revered in Ravka, like feared mainly.
Yeah, the only person I think from Shuhan that we get is the guy who like teaches them how to fight.
Oh yeah,
I don't remember his name.
Bodkin.
Yeah, I was gonna say it sounded Russian-ish to me, which was also interesting.
But I was just kind of surprised because yeah. of that like migrant story.
Mm-hmm. I think fantasy does this a lot though. Like whatever color the author is usually the color of all the people. But it, you know, it's real frustrating.
And I think we see Bardugo grow a lot in the Six of Crows duology.
Yeah, which is why I'm really excited to read it, because I'm like, I just want some different looking people that I can tell apart better.
Yeah, it was, I that was one of the biggest things I noticed, the difference between those two, between the two series that are set in the Grishaverse. I don't know, you just see Bardugo is more mature and more thoughtful and more inclusive in those books, which is a good thing. You're also allowed to grow. Class feelings.
So Jenya claims that Darkling freed her, but is she trading forced servitude for voluntary servitude? I have so many like conflicted feelings about Jenya.
Will you share with us?
Yeah. So she was doing the Darkling's bidding before, but he kind of used her as like a sex slave, in that he like gave her to the king. Well, he gave her to the queen, but she was forced into sexual acts, it is assumed, by the king.
He gave her to the queen knowing that right. the king had a penchant for servants.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, which is rape.
Yes.
Yeah. But then she seems to feel bad for what's going on with Alina, and almost as if she wants to in some way help Alina, but knows she can't because of the Darkling. And it's frustrating, but also I don't know that. Are you free if you just give yourself over to a different kind of like servant master, you know?
Who's the other master she's serving then?
I think it's always the Darkling, but I think in one way she's like being forced into having sex to being forced into just being his servant. I don't know, because she's like doing the bidding of the king and the queen at one point, and that turns to doing the bidding of the Darkling exclusively. Yeah, now that she's all disfigured and everything, I think that maybe she will turn away from the Darkling in some way. Maybe she'll be the one to kill him. That would be great.
Well, what he used her for was how pretty she was. So
yeah, she has no use to him anymore, which is also really sad. I feel bad for Jenya. There seems to be no apparent hierarchy of the Grisha with Stormhund / Nikolai. And we also see Alina try and get rid of those hierarchies when she takes over the Second Army.
When she comes into the little palace for the first time and is like, hey, I'm taking up the mantle. This is you're my army now. We do see the Heartrenders bristle at that, or some of them, mm-hmm. the ones who grew up under the Darkling.
Right.
But then, oh, who's the other guy? Her Heartrender. There's the other guy who saved her life one time. I can't remember his name.
I think his name starts with an F.
It does start with an F, okay. But I forget what it is. But he's on her side. Right. So we see she's brushing up against that when she first comes to insert herself mm-hmm. as the person who has power. It's almost like the people who she's going to have power over just want different hierarchy. They don't want a completely subverted, erased hierarchy.
Well, we kind of see that she's like forcing them to have like lunch together, like eat together and not sit at their like specific tables. But at the same time, it's almost like she tries to like reverse the order of the hierarchy, because she's like, all right, the Materialkai are going to learn how to fight and they're going to do, you know, all these things or whatever she wants them to do. But it's like she's trying to give more power to the people who previously had the least.
By weaponizing their knowledge, so not really sure if I'm on board with that.
Maybe she's just the Darkling part two.
That's certainly a tension that the book is exploring.
Yeah.
Another thing that, so going off of Alina wanting to get rid of the in theory, wanting to get rid of the Grisha hierarchy. The book also mentions that she wants to erase the lines that separated the Grisha from the Otkazatsia, who are the people without magical abilities. And supposedly, this is a reason behind why she chooses quote-unquote peasant clothes for her personal guard. But I think this is just lip service. She still refers to the people who worship her as fanatics. She's not, like, helping train the peasants so they can fight for themselves. She's not...
When she, like, slips up at that one point and says that she, like, doesn't want to have to look after a non-magical people. Like, she doesn't want more of them on her guard other than Mal. And Mal is, like, upset by this for obvious reasons and because he's upset about everything. But she, I think, wants the appearance of things being more equal as opposed to actually, like, feeling that they're equal.
Without actually, A, actively working for that, or B, giving up her power.
Right. She's not willing to give up anything.
This goes down an interesting road in book three. Okay. I hate to be the person who always dangles that, but...
No, it's okay.
You can do that to me when we read Mortal Instruments.
I like this depiction of Nikolai. Reminds me of the depictions we get of Queen Elizabeth in The Crown, where they're always on when their people can see them and always putting their people before themselves. I don't think Nikolai's as good at it as we see with Queen Elizabeth, at least in The Crown. I don't know about in real life what she does. But I kind of like that, where he's, like, trying to, like, bring up his people and give them things that they haven't had, like sugar. And there was something else. I don't remember what. Whatever that alcohol is they're always drinking.
Kvass.
Yeah. But I like how he's trying to, like, make his people happy, it seems like, at least.
I actually side with Mal on this.
Oh, okay.
Shocker. This is actually shocking.
How could you side with Mal?
Because Mal says that Nikolai is bribing the common people with sugar and jirda and kvass, which are non-essential things. And Nikolai says something to the effect of, I'm giving them hope, which is better than nothing. And Alina responds to that in her exposition, not out loud. And she says, it sounds... That makes sense coming from someone who's never had nothing.
Right.
At the end of the day, they're empty gestures because poverty is a trauma that rich people can't fully comprehend ever. And Nikolai is one of those people. And Nikolai doesn't try to comprehend what that experience is like. He tries to game the peasants like he's competing in a popularity contest. All he cares about is the appearance of seeming benevolent and gaining their love. I'm totally with Mal on this. And I don't believe he actually cares about their lives in substantive ways. Like, I don't think he wants his people to die, but he's not an accomplice who's trying to understand their struggle and make things better. If that were the case, he would give them, like, fucking jobs instead of some sugar. And then there'd also be no monarchy.
Yeah, it kind of makes me, now that you say that, think of, like, Tamlin in A Court of Mist and Fury, where he's like, I don't care if you're starving, I need this, your taxes.
Basically.
Oh, and I hate Tamlin so much, so I don't want Nikolai to be Tamlin.
I think Nikolai's a lot more complicated than Tamlin.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's a monarch and is trying to preserve monarchy and is trying to use his subjects in order to consolidate his power and make a bid for the throne, which is not his at this point.
Maybe not rightfully his at all.
Yeah, I mean, like, fuck rightful monarchy succession in general. But these tensions are always bubbling beneath the surface with Nikolai. He's always going to have some sort of, like, class stuff going on.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. We kind of continue from the last book with Alina's appearance stemming from her sickness or lack thereof, which is annoying still.
And it is interesting to me, going off of that, that the book is bookended, for lack of a better term, by Alina being incapacitated and sick.
Yeah.
She's on the boat and doesn't know what's going on at the beginning of the book. And then she is in the tunnels after her huge battle with the Darkling.
Or even in the very beginning of the book, she is not using her powers, and that's why she looks sick and frail.
I kind of feel bad for Alina. She can't just, like, be all the way herself.
No, because even when she's powerful and has her and, like, is using her powers and everything, then Mal's being shitty to her about wanting to have powers.
And she has this, like, huge mission to save the world, basically. Yeah. So she can't just, like, be for herself.
No.
By herself.
I guess that's in the way that she, like, learns what it's like to be Nikolai, I think, where he's, like, always on, and she, like, is trying to do that as well, because she's the person in charge now.
Right. I think she's realizing that Mal has this privilege of not having to perform.
Yeah, like he's that. Responsible for no one.
And I think she wishes she had that. I think she's a little bit jealous of the anonymity that being Otkazatsya was.
Well, we see that when she's like, I wish it could just go back to us, like, in the woods, traveling around, like, sleeping in hostels or whatever.
And that's why she's always clinging to those nostalgic memories of Kiremzen when it's just her and Mal, and there was no big world-shattering responsibility, and there wasn't this huge divide between her and him. And maybe we can think about this, about how, like, people who are sick, there is a divide between you and your partner.
Right.
If they're not sick.
Yeah, that's true.
Or you and your friends, or you and your family. Like, yeah. There's something that you, with if you have illness or chronic illness or whatever,
yeah,
that you experience, and you can't ever explain that fully to other people who haven't gone through that.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, as we both know, it's worse when it's, like, well, maybe not worse, but it's, like, really difficult when it's invisible, because no one knows you're sick. And so you still feel, like, separated from people who can be, like, healthy on a day-to-day basis while you're dealing with all these things. I don't know. It's anxiety-inducing.
Yeah. With invisible illness specifically, it seems like I have to defend the fact that I'm sick, or, right, like, explain it a lot more than people who have, like, visible illness.
No, I 100% agree.
It's just a different experience of illness.
It's almost like people don't believe that you're sick.
Yes. And you have to justify it.
Yeah.
Yeah, having to justify why you need X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, which is frustrating. And I'm sure people with, like, invisible disabilities, like, but I just know, like, sometimes, like, I have to be like, well, I know I don't look like I'm sick, but I don't feel good. So I can't be here right now. It's easier when you have someone who knows what that's like. So for me, that's you.
Right. Exactly.
But with other people, it's like, yeah, I know I don't seem sick, but, mm-hmm, like, you don't know what's going on.
Right. I think invisible illness requires that you disclose and justify.
Yeah.
More.
Which can be difficult, because it's also sometimes, like,
I don't want to. And so I think that there is this moment where the Darkling is right about one thing, where he's like, Mal will never understand you, speaking to Alina, and about your relationship to your power. And if we can see this kind of as a parallel towards illness, or like a different experience,
yeah,
then I think that's true. Like, there are times when, unless you've lived it, you can't understand in the same way.
Yeah, and even with illness, we could see it with, like, race. Like, if Alina and the Darkling were not white, but, like, they looked different as well, like, if they're the only two people of color in the room at all, like, they have a connection that, like, Mal and Nikolai aren't going to understand.
Right.
So it's kind of, like, about finding your community, maybe.
And there is something really nice when you find someone who can see you in the same way, because, yeah, they also have experienced that.
Exactly. That's why we're besties.
It's true.
Yeah, let's talk about Alina's PTSD. She has a lot going on, and I understand.
She's suffered. I shouldn't say suffered. Endured a lot of things.
She has. And I don't have PTSD, so I don't know that this is, like, lines up with symptoms or anything, but it is what we normally see as a depiction of PTSD, especially because she thinks she's having hallucinations. They turn out to be real, but she's, like, is triggered the right word by certain things?
Yeah. I think your point about having hallucinations, but they're actually ending up being real, reminds me of the Dumbledore at the end of Harry Potter. He's like, just because it's happening in your head doesn't mean it's not real. And those sorts of symptoms, like mental illness, people don't believe it a lot of the time.
Mental illness is like an invisible illness.
A lot of the time, yeah. We certainly see Alina having visceral and physiological symptoms in addition to, I guess, mental and emotional trauma that she's working through, or the symptoms of her trauma of having been through it.
Yeah, and she has that pain in her shoulder. Like, is it psychological or is it physical? And we don't know.
And I don't, at the end of the day, I'm not sure it matters, because the experience of pain either way.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree.
But Alina is certainly working through a lot of shit.
Yeah. And rightfully so. And none of the dudes in her life are helping in any way, shape, or form.
No, they just like, they're just like, make me feel better.
Yeah.
The Darkling wants that. The Mal wants that. Nikolai wants that.
She should just give them all up. I hope she ends up with no one.
Go appropriate that term, spinster. Go be Bagra.
So yeah, I hope Alina maybe gets some help in the next book. I don't know what's going to happen with Bagra. Maybe Bagra will help her in some way, I kind of hope. Because she's also gone through a lot with issues with the Darkling.
I think Bagra's another person who would be able to understand what Alina's been through, about being singular and different.
I think it's why Alina tries to connect with her. Like, she tries like, well, she doesn't put in that much effort, but she really wants that connection with Bagra. But Bagra's like, no thanks.
Yeah, I think they're both too scared.
Yeah, I don't think they want to confront the Darkling, but also like what problems he has caused in their life.
So. Right, that's a common thread, and he's mm-hmm. traumatized both of them.
Yeah, in very different ways, and they don't want to like deal with the pain of that, which makes sense because it's like it's an ongoing issue. So maybe they feel like they can't confront it until he's gone. Alina gets some help. She needs some therapy.
Yeah, Ravka could use universal therapy.
Yeah, universal healthcare in general.
Probably. Yes, that includes therapy.
Yeah, as it all should.
Nikolai, if you're going to be a monarch, get on it.
Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about asexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do a little shipping of our own. To me, Nikolai is better than Mal, and I think he actually loves Alina, not just the idea of who she used to be, and they should be together because I ship them. Hard. I ship them hard.
You bring up a really important part about how Mal has this idealized version of Alina, one that came before she discovered her power. So I don't think we can say that he loves her for all of her, because he's really scared about that part of her that he doesn't understand, the Grisha part, because that's not how she was when he knew her, you know, when they were growing up. And it's like, yeah, people change.
Especially as they get older, like, you were children.
Exactly. Of course she's different. She's like not prepubescent girl anymore.
Yeah. Mal is trash, and that's the thing for today. All the men in the book are trash.
They certainly do a lot of garbage stuff.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. I mean, I know it's hard because I'm also like, Nikolai like sexually assaulted Alina, and I don't know what to do with that because I also like him.
It's really hard because I think we can take this as a lesson of like, we don't want to cancel this character because we right. like him, but we can also hold him accountable right. and not let him off.
Like, he should apologize and own up to what he did being wrong in a genuine way.
Yeah, it's important to like not just cancel people all the way.
Right.
Most, like, the vast majority of cases,
if they are willing to be held accountable for it, I think then that's fine.
Right, because I think like actual healing and change comes from everyone working through their shit.
Right, exactly.
And being held accountable. But Mal could maybe attempt to learn more about Grisha magic and then understand Alina more. He hasn't lived that experience of right. being Grisha, but he could actually like not be scared of it.
It's like how people do the work to learn about different races and cultures and sexualities. Like, if you want to be there for someone who is different than you, then you have to learn about where they come from.
And you have to do the work. Yeah. Like, yourself. Don't put that on the person with that more marginalized identity.
Yeah. Mal needs to become an ally. And he's right now not. He is not.
Because he doesn't do any of that emotional work.
No. And he doesn't want to. He just wants old Alina back. It also feels a bit like Alina is staying with Mal more to prove the Darkling wrong than because she has romantic feelings for him. And that's also really frustrating.
I think that you're right, because I'm noticing that Alina, we could read her as being afraid that if she doesn't commit to Mal, she'll be too tempted by the Darkling. So it's almost like one is the path of righteousness and light, and the other is literally the path of darkness and villainy.
As if there's no like middle ground, but also Mal is not the path of righteousness.
It's interesting that her two choices for how she wants to live are paralleled by two male love interests.
Yeah, she needs to find a different path, I think.
Sexy times?
Meh.
Double meh. I don't feel the chemistry, the Mal-Alina chemistry.
I don't either.
Personally. I mean, if they feel it, I guess good for them.
That's not what shipping is about. I don't care what they feel.
I shipped Alina and Nikolai hard the first time I read this series.
Yeah. I don't know what she deserves. Whatever she wants, I guess. But I think Mal's a bad decision. And the Darkling is like, I mean, I guess he's Kylo Ren, so I say go for it.
Yeah, the Darkling has me so conflicted. I mean, he's supposed to be alluring, and Bardugo constructs him very effectively as this complicated, alluring character. But he's also, like, does so much bad stuff. He killed thousands of people by expanding the Fold.
For no reason.
Yeah, he's to make a point, yeah. Essentially. He uses people, but there's something, I don't know. He's still, there's like a humanity there also. I don't know.
I disagree. I don't, maybe part of it is because I see him as being like a lot older than Alina. And I think if you have an age difference in your relationship, that's fine, but it's not appealing to me. So I'm like, he's like an old man.
Maybe not like a 472 year age difference.
Yeah. Well, that's literally impossible that I'm aware of. Yeah, so for some reason I see him as like being like a lot older than her, and like he's not fatherly, but like I don't know, something about him just like he's not appealing to me in any way, shape, or form. So I'm kind of like meh.
I find him conflicting. I don't like that I find him appealing. That's, yeah. I'm frustrated with myself.
I don't mind when I like the villain. I think it's okay. Maybe because we don't have enough backstory about him, and I think I said this the last time, but something about like not having backstory on about him makes me think he's just like 100% evil and there's no humanity there. So I'm kind of like, eh, like why would you like him?
That's true. I have the curse of knowledge.
Yeah. So yeah, you're allowed.
Now we're going to talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and basically whatever else comes to mind in a segment called Kill Your Darlings.
Okay, so I had a few thoughts about the writing in this book. So in chapter 2, the italicized text is used to indicate both that Alina is unsure of what is real and used to indicate flashbacks. And I thought this was a strange choice because this section is also written in the present tense where the rest of the book is written in past tense. And I'm not sure if they write in present tense to signify urgency, maybe. But I thought that was a strange choice.
Yeah, I thought that those were disorienting, which maybe was the point.
Maybe it's supposed to disorient us as well.
Because the character is disoriented.
Right.
The character can't distinguish. So I think maybe that was a deliberate choice. I mean, yeah. It clearly was.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I don't think we usually get like these tense changes in stories.
Not very often. I think you're right. It was effective. It disoriented me.
Yeah. So this book is written in first person past tense. And I'm wondering what you think about writing in first person past tense, if that signifies to us that the narrator will survive. I just realized that you already know whether they survive or not. But I mean in books in general.
I think in general, yeah. Because otherwise the logic of the telling of the story doesn't hold up. Because the character has to live to reflect back and tell their own story.
Yeah, especially because we don't get like multiple POVs in this book in particular. But it kind of changes the way I read books a little bit now that I think about that.
That's a good point.
Like stories where it's possible that the hero could die. That doesn't often happen in books that I read. But by putting it in first person past tense, should I just always assume that the hero will live? Just changes the way I read things.
Or maybe they're like a specter talking from beyond the grave. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. If there's, it does create a little bit more suspense when it's present tense.
Yeah.
First person present tense and the character doesn't know what's going to happen to them. Or when it's like third person or omniscient or otherwise.
Yeah. Because like when I was reading Harry Potter, I don't think I had like the knowledge that there were going to be 7 books. So every time I was reading them and there wasn't already another book out, I was like, oh my God, is Harry going to die? But it's because it's written in third person.
I thought the pacing was way better in this book than the other book.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, like so much better.
And I think that happens a lot with a lot of first books in a series.
Yeah, I remember an author saying once that sometimes the second book in a series is like the least read book, which I thought was surprising because I feel like, oh, you know the characters, like you feel like comfortable with them, you know what like kind of to expect. And so I was surprised to hear someone say that. So
I think a lot of the world building happens in book one.
Yeah, which is a lot of work. I like this one better. Partly because of Nikolai. I'm so done with Mal.
So done. I think that we see gradually the stakes getting higher and that Bardugo does that very effectively.
Yeah. But now I think that Alina survives because of her choice of...
And because of your unrelenting optimism. It's a joke, listeners.
I'm not optimistic about most things. Everything's gonna be terrible in the end.
Are you looking forward to book 3?
Yes, I really thought about just reading it right away, but I know I'll forget too many details by the time we talk about book 3 that I was like, I better just wait.
Recommend if you like the first book, question mark?
Yeah.
Even if you weren't that into the first book, I think you should read the second book.
I wasn't that into the first book, and the second book was a lot better. I really, really liked it. I'd give it like 4 out of 5 stars. Awesome. If you liked the first book, if you didn't like the first book, give the second one a try, because maybe you'll like this one better.
Also, because then you'll have read the Grisha series before King of Scars comes out in 2019.
Yeah, I'm really excited to read that book now. But I feel like you probably will have to have read these books. Maybe. I don't know.
I think you'll get extra layers if you have read them.
I wonder if it'll go back farther into Nikolai's past so that we get more about him.
I don't know if we'll get flashbacks.
I just imagine, but I guess, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
We'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to.
Thanks for listening to JK It's Magic. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of City of Bones by Cassandra Clare, the first book in the Mortal Instruments series. And watch out for more minisodes about a range of fantasy-adjacent topics.
You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at JKMagicPod. Post or tweet about the show using the hashtag CriticallyReading. Do you have an idea for a book that we should add to our TBR? Email us at jkmagicpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions.
Know a friend who would enjoy the podcast? Please spread the word. You can subscribe to JK It's Magic on Apple Podcasts, Google Play /podcasts, and Stitcher. We'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review the show. JK It's Magic is recorded on lands traditionally belonging to the Ute, Cheyenne, and Arapaho Native peoples. See you in a fortnight.